I'm going to pause just a moment. Okay. And I understand that the Society began co-sponsorship of the Studies in Legal History series that was published by Harvard University Press in 1971. Can you talk about how that was arranged, and were the books in the series popular?
The affiliation with Harvard, which lasted from 71 to about 73, 74, was an interesting connection. I think it probably was worked originally through Hillers Obel. Harvard published the legal papers of John Adams, and Hiller had worked closely with them. I was not directly involved in that, but I think another person that was involved in it was Stanley Katz, who is a person that is incredibly enthusiastic and incredibly, at least he was, I suppose he's my age or older, and he's no longer quite as energetic as he was once. But Stan went to Harvard and was very well connected at Harvard. So I think probably between him and Hiller, the connection to Harvard was made. And of course George, because of his Harvard upbringing, knew a lot of people at Harvard. The Harvard University Press did undertake to publish books for the Society. Stan was to become the editor of the venture, and we would create an editorial advisory board who would pass on recommending books to Harvard. And the first book that came out was a book by an English scholar, C.H.S. Byfoot, who wrote a biography of Frederick William Maitland. Maitland was the sort of the guru of English legal history in the 1890s, 1900s, and lived till about 1920. His biography is something that most legal historians would want to read or at least know about. Mm-hmm. Again, he's an institutionalist. He's not a law and society man by any standard. But that biography was the first book in the series. The second one was some selected letters of Oliver Wendell Holmes. Those are the first two books in the series. If I could get a list of them for you, it would help. Let me put it this way. I think the books enjoyed a modest sale among the members of the Society, and of course they did have a reduction in the price of the books because of the Society's sponsorship. The problem was that the Society didn't bring money to the project. And money is the key to publication. Even in those days, it cost several thousand dollars to get something into print. Without electronic means of publication and so on, this is not the easiest thing to do. And Harvard itself was moving more toward general purpose books, general reading books, rather than scholarly monographs at that point. And so the association went along fairly well until, I would estimate, about 1973, at which point they informed the Society, one, they wanted Society subsidies for the publications, and two, their board of directors or their syndics or whatever their reviewing panel was would be able to reject books selected for the series. And George wanted nothing to do with this. His attitude was, I don't have time to haggle with with these people at Harvard University Press. Will you do it? And with a Columbia PhD, I had nothing committed to Harvard at all. So one of the tasks I had was to negotiate with Harvard and also to find an alternative publication outlet for the series. Harvard, it was clear, was not going to back down. They wanted to control the imprint of the series, despite the fact that we had 5 or 10 of the best qualified legal historians in the United States on the advisory board. George was not at all remiss in calling on his buddies to serve on these boards, and we really did have a blue ribbon board at that point. And they also wanted money, which of course, that solved the problem. We didn't have it. It was just not available. I mean, you need a lot of money to bring up thousands and thousands of dollars of subsidies for even 2 books a year. So one of the interesting things was that my connection at that point was with the University of North Carolina Press, which had gone through some difficult times with the Institute of Early American History and so on. But they had agreed to publish the Marshall Papers, and by that time I was the co-editor of the Marshall Papers. And I was, my neck was on the line because I lost the job if we lost the publisher for that series. So basically I went to Matt Hodson, who was the director of the University of North Carolina Press, really with a loaded shotgun, ready to fight for the publication of the Marshall Papers by North Carolina. And we ended up being very good friends as a result of that conversation. And Matt was interested in picking up the Studies in Legal History series. And he picked it up, and I think it stayed in association of the society from 1973 until a year or two ago, when they finally moved to Cambridge University Press.
So almost 40 years.
Yes. I wouldn't even think to tell you how many books. But again, the problem really was a problem of money and book subsidies, my friends at the North Carolina Press seemed to indicate that they really were not in a position to compete with Cambridge in terms of total number of titles per year. I mean, the society has been fantastically successful with this. I don't know that it's been a financial success, but academically, they have published across the whole spectrum of legal history. At sometimes 4 and 5 titles a year for this whole period of time. About 6 years ago, my college classmate Harry Scheiber, who was the president of the society just recently, started a program to raise money for the society to create an endowment for the society, with the idea that it will be used to give prizes to younger scholars for good work, and also to subsidize publication. And my suspicion is that probably carried the society forward in the North Carolina Press relationship pretty far along in terms of having some subsidy money available. Whoever does the oral history for that can flesh that out a little bit more. But the point simply is that I think North Carolina Press was not able to carry the series with the number of titles that were coming out. And for that reason, they moved to Cambridge University Press, which has an entirely different publication viewpoint. And is quite willing to publish scholarly books, but essentially Cambridge publishes for the library market. So a book that costs $150 would come out from Cambridge University Press. Mm. Most of us don't buy $150 books, but libraries will. So in a sense, it's done, the arrangement is probably the best that you could get for a society like the Society for Legal History. At the same time, I was rather sad to see the association with the University of North Carolina Press end, because it's a good press, mm-hmm. and they do good work. But the titles are just all over the field, and some of them sold very well. Most of them, I'm afraid. Just yeah. simply, they're on library shelves.
Right.
But that association, I think, was a very good one for that mm-hmm. long period of time. And of course, I wasn't executive assistant to the president at that point. I was the vice president of the society.
Vice president?
Yeah.
So the next question is about the American Journal of Legal History.
Yes.
That was published by Temple University School of Law until the 1980s, but was superseded as the Society's journal by Law and History Review.
That's right.
Now, why didn't the Society launch its own journal earlier?
Well, again, the answer is money.
Right.
Money makes a great deal of difference. The American Journal for Legal History had been the official publication of the Society from the time it began in 1957 until until the Law and Society, Law and History Review took over in, I think, 1985, 86, mm-hmm. something like that. And incidentally, American Journal for Legal History is still being published and is probably the journal that we would have liked it to have been in 1970-71, in that it does get some very good articles. It does a moderately good job of mm-hmm. doing book reviews as the important books come out. But at the same time, it seemed to be foundering in the 70s. We tried in various ways to shore it up. George had a number of contacts with the Supreme Court, and there was one point at which he and I went to visit with the Chief Justice Warren, who was on the board of the American Journal for Legal History. And the Chief Justice was very much interested in improving that journal, and basically, as a consequence of that meeting, George was able to convince the journal to, and Temple University, to move over into a book review editor who was Fred Konevsky of the Papers of Daniel Webster, Bill Nelson, who was George's colleague at the University of Pennsylvania, became the book review editor. So that journal really began to improve fairly quickly. Before that time, Erwin Serensee, who had been very active in the society and was editor of the journal until probably 1990, 2000, something like that, had been trying to keep the thing going, but it was fairly obvious that he was having difficulty getting articles and published most of his own articles in the journal. It was fairly clear that he was not drawing the broad number of scholars and good scholars that we needed to have in the journal. And we were interested in the 70s of getting another journal, but at the same time, with all the other things going on, coupled with the fact that we didn't have money, really it was not possible until much later that the board and the officers of the society were able to work with another institution, another academic institution, to have the journal edited and then published as a separate journal. So we were certainly pleased to have that happen, but at the same time, practically, we had neither the manpower or womanpower to do the work, nor did we have the money to support a journal and staff it and get the, all the mechanics of publication. So that was the last thing really that was important for us in terms of the way in which the journal would be a good outlet for publication. Now it's killed with submissions. I mean, its submission rate of manuscripts runs, I think, between 200 and 300 articles a year. And from those, they can obviously only pick maybe 15 or 20. They've recently gone from 3 issues a year to 4 issues a year to be a real quarterly. But still, and they've had excellent editors of the Law and History Review. It takes a lot of money, though. And a lot of contacts and a lot of staff to work to run it.
Right. When you were actively affiliated with the Society's business for the 30 years from 1970...
Well, I wasn't active after 1980 was the last time.
Okay.
I really was active after that. I would go to annual meetings.
Okay, in terms of board work, you were on the board?
I was on the board and... I guess it's 97 through 99 or something like that.
Okay. Right.
And I was with the delegate to the American Council for Learned Societies from 77 to 80.
80, yes. Okay. Yes.
But after that, I've been a very enthusiastic member of the society.
Okay.
But really...
nothing in terms of forming policy or anything like that. Just... the active interest.
So you're talking about really old oral history.
That's the kind we like. during the time that you were active, though, I understand that there was an effort to publish colonial court records with the Irish University Press.
Yes.
What can you tell us about that?
Again, this is something that John Cushing, were he alive, would be able to tell you some interesting things. Irish University Press was not a university press. It was a commercial enterprise.
And where was it
located? It was located in Dublin. Okay. And the press was interested in getting the published court records of all the American colonies and republishing them by facsimile in leather-bound volumes and selling them as a set. Their earlier effort had been to collect the parliamentary papers, the British parliamentary papers, which you may be familiar with. These are exhaustive studies prepared in the 19th century about sewerage in England, about water supply, about public health, about factories, about air pollution. The list of things goes on, and these are things written by parliamentary commissions specifically delegated to it to address these various things. A fabulous source for all areas of history is what they were. But the problem, of course, with facsimile preparation is you've got to get a very good photograph of every page, have very good photographers.
Yeah.
And they apparently had really succeeded extremely well and had sold enough copies of these relatively expensive sets to be looking for something else to do. And they decided that American court records were the things to contact. Now, this had been an enthusiasm of the American legal historians back in the 1930s. Earlier than that, it had been a selective thing. With the exception of Virginia and primarily Massachusetts and the New England colonies, most of those records were still in manuscript, but those two were in print. And of course, John, as librarian of the Massachusetts Historical Society, was an ideal source for the original copies that would be photographed and then make part of that series. And so they contacted either some other legal historian or perhaps John directly and said, we would like to do this. If you will let us have the printed records, we will unbind them so that we can take adequate pictures. I mean, try to, if you've ever done a photocopy of a book, you know what the problem is.
Yeah,
we will unbind them and then we will rebind them in leather and send them back to you. Okay. And so they started on this process, and the society enthusiastically endorsed this operation, which got us to Captain Todd McClinchy. McClinchy was one of these one of these almost unique Irishmen, in the sense, well, I guess it's not unique, Rick of the Irish, loved to drink, knew every pub in Dublin, and had frequented them. And one legal history meeting we had at Williamsburg, he was delayed in getting there because he had gotten into an altercation with the stewardess, who tried to take his drink away as the plane was landing in Newport News. But absolutely incredible character. John Cushing, at one point in the career of this project, went to visit McClinchy in Dublin. And you can see this dour New Englander, proper to the nth degree, traveling around to every pub in Dublin with this crazy Irishman. But what was an amusing thing turned out to be something of a tragedy, because the place went bankrupt after the books were unbound. Oh. And no money to rebind them in cloth, no less leather. Hmm. And as a consequence, a lot of the books really were not in good shape when they got back to Massachusetts Historical and other societies that owned them. But it was an interesting interlude for the Society for Legal History, and I think an interesting interlude for the librarian world, that you don't enter into these things unless you're sure that the publisher is going to going to survive and do well. But that unfortunately just simply didn't work out well. It was a little bit of color in a publications is an interesting area. One thing I didn't touch upon in the publications area, in the journal, the American Journal for Legal History, one of the periods of negotiation with Temple University Press was that the publications committee was to go to Philadelphia and talk with them about the journal. Well, the visit really, like a lot of diplomatic visits, produced nothing in terms of change in the journal. Mm. But the dean of the law school, who subsequently became president of Temple, and Peter Lee, of course, to entertain the committee, took them to a Greek restaurant someplace in Philadelphia. Yeah. And this committee at that point consisted of Arthur Hoag, who was a staid, independent Indiana professor of English legal history and an author of a book on the Magna Carta; Kitty Pryor, who was distinguished colonial historian on the faculty at Wellesley, and John Cushing. And being squired around the Philadelphia nightlife until they arrived at this Greek restaurant where a belly dancer was entertaining the group. Well, the society, when the rest of us learned about this wonderful opportunity in the publications committee, we decided we all should be members of the publications committee. But if you had known the characters involved from the society side, you would see this is one of the more humorous areas of society negotiations. Right. It still didn't change Temple University's view. As I said about the book earlier, the journal earlier, it really has come very far. I still subscribe to it. There are still some excellent articles coming out in it, and the net result is we split off from Temple at that time in the mid-80s. But as a practical matter, you've gotten two outlets for legal history writing rather than one. Right. Which, of course, is the best of all possible conclusions. But the poor publications committee worked hard in that Philadelphia meeting to win the society's point of view.
I will note that you did talk to some degree about what you felt was accomplished in that time period from 1970s to 77. Mm-hmm. Do you feel there's something more to add than what we discussed? I didn't ask the question specifically. If you were evaluating that progress during that time period.
Well, one of the difficulties really is that for me, after 77, and certainly after 80, it's difficult because there was a period of time there where I was pretty much out of anything except teaching or research. My wife was taken ill with her second bout with cancer and died in 1980. And for about 3 or 4 years after that, I was busy taking care of children and doing the variety of things that one has to do to keep the world together. At that point, I sort of lost contact. But I did have the impression, and I think I'm right, that the society was beginning to run like a learned society. There was no need to bail out the program committee, as I had to do 1 year, where we were 5 months from the meeting and the program wasn't established. Those kind of emergencies didn't rise for the offices to intervene and take over things. The publications was already well established and running along regularly. The editors, if they retired or resigned, would be replaced routinely with someone of equal quality and so on. Because again, you had the large number of people to draw from. And people who, because of the annual meeting and the things the society was doing, were perfectly happy to help, assuming they had the time and the inclination to do that type of work. So I do think the hectic scramble of the early 70s had slowed down considerably by 1980. And certainly when I came onto the board in the mid-90s, what you had was the major decisions that a board has to make, but none of the concern with the operating details of the society.
Right.
And it stayed that way. Essentially, one of the things that surprised me getting ready for this interview, I looked up the society in the ACLS directory of societies, and I discovered they claim 500 members instead of 1,000, or close to 1,000. Mm. But they have 300 of those members coming to the annual meeting every year, which is just incredible in terms of the way. In other words, because dues have gone up and commitments have changed and so on, you've dropped in total membership, but you've dropped into a total membership that is very, very much involved. 300, 350 people that are coming every year to the annual meeting, and presumably sending their manuscripts and sending the books to the articles to the journal. So I think in terms of operations, in terms of the way in which the society is seen, and in the way in which it's occupied a place in the humanities, it's at a stable point, and you can sort of. I mean, the kid has grown up, and you just simply watch it and are amazed at what it accomplishes.
Right.
At least from my point of view, that's what it is. I can peacefully sit back and know that it will be well run and a great organization.
I know there's the society has some questions that they'd like specifically for me to ask you.
Okay.
Information that they'd like to gather. And one of them is, if you had to make a short list, what generally are regarded as your most important works?
You mean my works with the society?
I think it means as your career, in terms of your career.
In terms of career, generally. It's hard to pin that down. A lot of things I've started that I have not finished, like the papers of John Marshall. I had 10 years on that project, and really a very active role in collecting the manuscripts and particularly an active role in gathering the sources for Marshall's law practice. By the time I left the Marshall papers in 1977 and came here to South Carolina, that work had just started. They only published two volumes of the series. It ran to 13 volumes, which I anticipated. I had projected that length in the early 1970s that it would take that many volumes to cover the materials we had already collected. That series from roughly 1981-82 on was edited by Chuck Hobson. So I don't claim that as my great achievement. I mean, I basically did a lot of the basic work. And I must say, selfishly, the most interesting work of gathering the manuscripts. He had the very hard work of editing them and putting them together and getting them into press and so on. We've stayed great friends over the years. And I'm very grateful to him that he picked it up and did such a wonderful job. But that's not really my great achievement, I don't think. The society itself, I think, is my greatest achievement.
Yeah. Is that how you feel?
Yes.
In what ways?
Well, it's critical, I think, to realize that scholarship is very much a joint thing. I'm currently working on the career of Sir Edward Cook, and I don't know anything about English legal history. I mean, I've never looked at the manuscripts. Mm-hmm. I've never dug into this carefully. I'm stealing with footnotes from other scholars that have done the work, and I think I can trust to be very careful and precise in their work. the society is like that to me too. I mean, I go to an annual meeting, and if I want to learn about medieval history, as I had recently, I sit in on the medievalists and listen to their papers. If I want to learn about English legal history in the 17th century, I sit in on those papers. And I can always write to the scholars and say, would you please send me a copy of your paper if it's not going to be published, or even if it is published, I want to use it now to write with. I'll cite the publication when it comes out. We've done an incredible job of increasing legal history as, one, something that's taught in the law schools, and two, something that has a substantial impact in the undergraduate and graduate curricula throughout the country. Mm. And we've done that at a time in which basically history is not interested in political history or legal or constitutional history any longer. We're the single standing bedrock for that type of study. And to me, that's an important contribution. Mm. Now, people may say, well, I've never heard of that guy. And that's really not important in terms of the way in which scholarship is advanced. Making journals available for publication of articles, making a book series available for publications and monographs, that's very important. That, in effect, is built a foundation upon which people 20, 30, 40 years from now can build. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very important thing. Other than that, I mean, I've done a lot of things that people sort of know about. George and I collaborated on the second volume of the Marshall Papers, the Holmes Device, mm-hmm. Volume that deals with John Marshall's chief justiceship. George had me take the second part of that thing, which dealt with looking at all of the law decisions, not the constitutional decisions as much as the law decisions, mm-hmm. the black letter law of commerce and public lands and things of that sort. And I wrote the second half of that and published it in 1981. What else have I done? And I've written on Marshall, oh gosh, it's a cottage industry for me, articles and things on Marshall. I hope what the most important thing I will do is this book, a series of books on the divergence of English constitutionalism and American constitutionalism from the colonial period and the Cook period to the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. There, my main problem is I have a deadline, not the normal deadline, that's when the publisher is waiting for the manuscript. My deadline is a real one. I have to live long enough to write it. But I think that in and of itself is a kind of a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
One of my real heroes was Lawrence Henry Gibson, who wrote a multi-volume history of the American colonies from 1748 and ended up in 1748, a painfully, carefully written book. He ended up, he started at the age of 65, and he ended up indexing the whole thing, probably at the age of 92, 93, mm-hmm. 94, and about 6 months after he completed his index, mm-hmm. he died. And I'm kind of superstitious.
You're hoping if you keep going with
if
it,
I keep
it'll
plugging,
keep you going.
If I keep going, it'll keep me going. But even if I don't publish anything, I think it's wonderful to be able to learn something new. And of course, mm-hmm. the trouble too is that I may not meet that deadline, but I may start writing beyond the deadline. Mm-hmm. There's a point at which scholars shouldn't write anymore. Their judgment gets bad, and their understanding gets dim, and basically they should say goodbye and just live a comfortable life after that. And I hope if that time comes, my wife, who is a good critic, will say, it's about time you stopped, before a colleague catches me. But I think I have enough friends to stop me
right
before that, too.
Yeah.
So it's fun, really. Yeah. It's a lot of fun. And the society's been a lot of fun.
I know we talked about your first contact and association with the society in 1961.
Right.
Do you have any knowledge or heard stories about the actual founding of the society, when that was, and who was involved with the founding? Did it precede 61 by much?
Well, it was supposedly done, and again, this is not my recollection, but what I know from documents and so on, it was a meeting in 1956, and it might have been as early as the American Law Institute meeting, which would have been in May, June of 56. Someone decided they should really start a Society for Legal History. Just before in the midst of the Depression in 1934, they had done this. The bunch of law professors had gotten together and thought this was the thing to do. I think there's almost no record of anything beyond that.
Mm.
But they were publishing court records. The Littleton Griswold Fund had published court records beginning in, the middle to late 20s, early 30s, and up until the Second World War. And they've even published records subsequent to that, though. I think the last one was probably 1975 or 80. So the court records have been published sporadically.
Hmm.
But nobody had really wanted to build a society until they got to 1956, which... And that was the point in time where they started the Journal for Legal History. I think the first issues came out in 1957. When I joined, there was a newsletter of sorts in 1961 telling you who had done what and where and so on, but nothing more than that. McKnight at Southern Methodist is probably the only person surviving who was part of that original group back into the 56-57 period. I dealt with a number of people who were still on the board of directors when I became executive assistant in 1970. But again, you're talking about people that were alive and well and operating in 56, mm-hmm. which meant they would have to be born in, at the latest, 1935, something like that. Probably long before then.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Morris was born in 1905. Joe Smith, who was my vice president in the society, was born in 1914.
Oh, yeah.
So you're dealing with people who are already well into their academic careers when the society is formed.
Right.
So really, except for Joe McKnight, and he has very few remembrances of those days. They passed the way beyond oral history contact at this point. So really it's the 70s that, and what I consider the reform or revision of the society in the 1970s that I know about.
Yeah. One of the questions is, who have been some of the most important figures in the history of the society? And I think that you've talked about the major figures, mm-hmm. but to be succinct in answering the question, is there sort of in your mind the core list of people in those early years?
I think I've given you the names of most of mm-hmm. them that occurred to me.
Mr. Cummings and
Cushing and
I apologize, I won't try
no, that's
to
okay.
recall them.
I think I've covered most of them for
yeah.
you.
Yeah, okay.
From that early period. Again, you know, the problem of naming names is that you miss somebody who is very important,
mm-hmm.
Which is an unfortunate thing. But I think I covered most of them.
And you talked about some of the characters involved over the years as
mm-hmm.
well. And they'd like to know what is the most humorous incident that you remember concerning the society.
Well, I told you about McClinchy and the
yeah.
Irish University Press, and of course the Publications Committee and the public, the belly dancer. I think those are probably the two. I guess we're
yeah.
kind of a dull group. Some historians are a kind of a dull group anyway. A story is circulated when I was young about maids in a hotel talking about academic meetings, and they said, oh yes, historians, they're not very interesting. The other disciplines are womanizing all over the place and so on, and all the historians do is drink. Which I suppose is probably true of us. We're sort of a dull group in that sense. I suppose it's something of a puritanical aspect to historians, but and legal historians maybe more than most. I'm sure my colleagues can tell you all sorts of amusing things.
Yeah.
if they were, you were to interview them. And as I say, one of the things that we do lack is that wonderful period, really from 1980 on, where so many people were interacting with each other.
Mm-hmm.
What you really want to do in building an annual program is to get somebody who's going to fight with each other, match your people on a panel that they're going to get into a really good fight. I've never witnessed that in the American Society for Legal History. Maybe they are fighting at a level I don't understand. but it doesn't seem to be that. Now, in terms of writing book reviews and so on, legal historians are rather known to be fairly critical. I've had a number of my books criticized for repeating the same materials again. You pick something out of a text with your computer and you move it someplace else, but you left it. And I've had a couple of people say, you know, if this manuscript had been edited, we wouldn't have had to read it in two places the same material. And unfortunately, with a computer, it's the same verbiage mm-hmm. too. So one of the interesting things is to read book reviews by historians. There they will clash a little bit, but that's really not humorous. That's kind of sort of in the club joke about who's looking things a certain way.
Right.
They've ignored some of these major issues about lawyers versus historians versus political scientists versus practicing lawyers and so on. I think that's an area that that we probably could devote a lot less time to. Because a lot of the people, the society isn't the only one that's made differences here. The University of Wisconsin, the law and history program at Princeton, the fellowships at Harvard, have all made it possible for historians to actually go to a law school and spend a year sitting in on the courses they need to learn. And we would differ as to what they should learn. But certainly the exposure to a different academic discipline is very useful without immersing yourself in the whole thing. People of intelligence can do that without being subjected to what most of us were subjected to is law school and graduate school, or vice versa, graduate school and then law school. So that increasingly legal history has become enough of an independent discipline that we're not about to take nonsense from historians that blunder in without knowing what they're talking about. And likewise, historians are not going to tolerate lawyers who have no concept of the parameters of influence on the way in which law develops. So I think that's a very valuable thing. But again, it's not humor. It's a very serious way in which the profession has developed. And I think that's a very good thing.
And why would you encourage young people to go into the study of history today?
Well, I encourage them to go into the study of legal history because a historic aspect is something that increasingly is lacking in legal studies. One of the big debates in legal studies, and it depends what you think a lawyer should do, the way in which a lawyer's mind should operate. We have here and in almost every other law school in the United States now, a very active and very effective clinical legal education program where law students get an opportunity to go out into the community and do the things that lawyers will do under the supervision of faculty members who themselves are practitioners in emphasis. That's a very important adjunct to the academic study. But the academic study is important too, and that's where legal history comes in. One of the most interesting things I did is, while I was teaching here, I developed a case book on what I called American legal and constitutional history. And one of my emphases outside of the areas in which I'm really interested in has always been the Dred Scott case, which most lawyers don't know very much about at all. But it's a critical case. You can criticize Taney for being insensitive about the question of slavery and race and so on and so forth, but after all, he was a Southerner, born, a Marylander as a Southerner, born in the early years of the 19th century. But Dred Scott is a very important case to understand the 14th Amendment upon which almost all constitutional law today is based. And one of my students, after we had dealt with Dred Scott and then moved into the 14th Amendment, said, "It's the first time I've understood the 14th Amendment." And I said, "That's right. You cannot understand the 14th Amendment until you've understood Dred Scott. Because it changes the nature of American federalism." And students need to get back to the pre-Civil War Constitution to understand the present constitution. And I think there are a number of areas like that where our work is not to train them as historians, but to train them that something happened that's more important than the latest decision of the Supreme Court last week. And that's not only true in constitutional law, it's true in every area of law. The feminists for years messed up discussing the status of women in common law in England and in the United States. I think I reviewed a book that was published maybe 10 years ago. I think 10 years ago. Finally, the people writing on the status of women did a superb job. Not that they changed the view of what the law was in the 19th and 18th century, but what they changed was the way in which society worked with the law. It's an interesting way in which, for example, many Southern males were qualified to vote, not because they owned land, but because their wives owned the land. And they got the right to vote because their wives owned land. Yeah. Or in electioneering, there were all kinds of statutes about men entertaining, what historians call swilling the planters with bumbo, with liquor, so you'd vote for them. It was done all over the place. But who invited them to the plantation to drink and enjoy themselves before they cast their ballots? Not the candidates, the little woman who was married to the candidates. And, you know, when you begin to look at things that way, you can see the interrelationship of social mores with legal, supposedly legal rules that you do not break at your peril. Women use powers of attorney that their husbands gave them to manage their affairs. It was the husband working, but the wife made the decision while they were absent. It's the only way to play in things or run things, but on the other hand, it was really strictly outside the legal loop. That kind of thing, I think, is very difficult to understand unless you've had some cross-training in law and history, but at the same time that you're sensitive to the variations that are possible, that to a modern person looking back are not obvious. And the thing that's really been accomplished with the law and society movement is that finally lawyers are sensitive to those external pressures that operate within legal history. And as I say, that's something that's really, to me, very exciting. And it's being done very well, really for the first time. And I think it's something like the Legal History Society that's made that possible. I mean, we all learn from each other. We even learn from our students. And that's an important thing. If you get people together, they will work with you, they will work against you, but they sure will work in a way that makes you understand what you think better because you had their input to it. I think it's a wonderful organization. I'm proud to have been involved with it.
Is there anything else that you would like to add that possibly I forgot to ask?
I can't think of anything. I will try to make sure to send you the names of everybody that I've mentioned that
okay.
we haven't identified. And I'm sure you'll be after me for the same.
Yes, well, thank you so
same
much.
Information. Well, thank you for doing the interview. I do appreciate it.